of telling him about the Down syndrome scare, which in turn leads to explaining about Isabel. And then I start crying and can't finish my steak.
I'm sorry, he says quietly when I've finished. You've had a horrible time.
I shrug and wipe my eyes.
Everyone has problems, don't they? It's the hormones. They make me weep at anything right now.
I wanted a family with Emma.
He's silent for a moment.
I was going to propose to her. I've never told anyone that. Funny, it was moving here that made me decide. Being settled at last.
I knew she'd been going through a difficult patch, but I put that down to the burglary. Why didn't you? Propose, I mean.
Oh, he shrugs. I wanted to do the most amazing proposal ever. Like those virals where the man gets a flash mob to sing the girl's favorite song or spells out, "Will you marry me?" in fireworks or something. I was just trying to come up with an idea, something that would really blow her away. And then, out of the blue, she ended it.
Personally, I've always found those videos of over-the-top proposals a bit weird, even creepy. But I decide now isn't the time to say so.
You'll find someone else, Simon. I know you will.
Will I?
He gives me a significant look.
It's quite rare I meet someone I feel I've made a real connection with, actually.
I decide this has to be said. Simon, I hope you don't think this is presumptuous of me, but since we're talking so openly, I just want to make something clear. I like you, but I'm definitely not looking for a relationship at the moment. I have enough on my plate.
Of course, he says quickly. I never thought...
But we're in a good place, right? As friends.
Yes.
I smile at him to show I appreciate his tact.
Although you'll probably change your mind about being in a relationship if Edward Monkford snaps his fingers at you, he adds.
I frown. I really won't.
Only joking. In fact, there is a girl I've been seeing a bit of. She lives in Paris. I'm thinking of moving over there so I can see more of her.
The conversation passes on to other things, pleasant and easy. I've missed this, I think. This niceness, this civilized give and take, so different from Edward's dominating presence. Later, he says,
Would you like me to stay tonight, Jane? On the sofa, obviously. But if it would make you feel safer.
That's kind, but we'll be fine. I pat my belly. Me and my bump?
Sure. Another time, perhaps.
13. There is often a large gap between my goals and my outcomes. Agree or disagree?
Now, Jane. I wake up tired and lethargic. Probably the tiny amount of alcohol from the night before, I decide, now that I'm so unused to it. Morning sickness clutches at my guts and I retch into the toilet. And then, just when I'm desperate for a shower, housekeeper chooses its moment to turn everything off. Jane, please score the following statements on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is strongly agree and 5 is strongly disagree. Some house facilities have been disabled until the assignment is completed.
Bugger, I say wearily. I really don't have the energy for this.
But I need that shower. I look at the first statement on the list. If my children weren't successful at school, I'd correctly be labelled a bad parent. Agree or disagree? I choose slightly agree, then stop dead. I'm fairly sure there's never been a metric about parenting before. Are these questions random? Or is this something more, some kind of subtle coded dig on housekeeper's part? As I go on through the questionnaire, I notice something else. I feel different. Just answering these questions reminds me that living here is a privilege reserved for a select few. That leaving will be almost as great a wrench as losing Isabel. I catch myself, appalled. How can I think such a thing, even for an instant? I remember what the lecturer said when he took around that group of students.
You probably aren't aware of it, but you're currently swimming in a complex soup of ultrasonics, mood-enhancing waveforms.
Are housekeeper's questions somehow part of how One Folgate Street works? I connect to the neighbor's Wi-Fi and type some of the questions I've just answered into Google. Immediately, there's a match. A scientific paper in an obscure-sounding medical magazine, the Journal of Clinical Psychology. The questions in the perfectionism assessment tool measure a variety of types of maladaptive over-perfectionism, including personal perfectionism, high standards for others, need for approval, planfulness, obsessive neatness and organization, ruminants, obsessive overthinking, compulsive behavior, and moral inflexibility. I skim through, trying to get my brain around the technical language. It seems the questions were originally designed by psychologists as a way to diagnose unhealthy, pathological perfectionism so it could be treated. Just for a moment, I wonder if that's what's been happening here. If the house is monitoring my psychological well-being just as it checks my sleep patterns, weight, and so on. But then I realize there's another explanation. Edward isn't using the questionnaire to treat his tenant's perfectionism, but to bolster it. He's trying to control not just our surroundings or even the way we live in them, but our innermost thoughts and feelings. This relationship will continue only for as long as it's absolutely perfect. I shiver. Was it a poor score on a psychometric test that sealed Emma's fate? I finish the questions, ticking whatever answers I think housekeeper will score me highest on. When I'm done, my laptop reboots. The lights come back on. I stand up, relieved to be finally heading for the shower. But as I'm going up the stairs, there's a glitch. The lights flicker. My laptop freezes mid-reboot. Everything hangs for a moment. And then, looking downstairs, I see something appear on my screen. Like a movie. Except this isn't a movie. Puzzled, I go back down for a closer look. It's an image of me. A live image, here in this very room. As I get closer, the figure on the screen moves farther away. The camera's behind me. Picking my laptop up, I turn around. Now the screen shows my face instead of the back of my head. I scan the wall in front of me until the screen tells me I'm staring straight at the camera. Except there's nothing there. Perhaps a tiny pinprick in the pale stone. No more. I put the laptop down and click the window to close it. Behind it is another window, another image, and another, all showing different areas of One Folgate Street. I close each one, though not before I've registered where the cameras are. One shows the stone table from a different angle. The second is pointed at the front door. The next shows the bathroom. The bathroom! Open plan, the shower completely exposed. If these are One Folgate Street sensors, who else has access to them? I click again. The final camera is mounted directly above the bed. I feel sick. All those times it felt as if I was being watched. It's because I was. And not just in bed either. When Edward took me over the kitchen counter, we'd have been in full view of the cameras. I shudder, revolted. And then, in a sudden sluicing cascade of hormones, my revulsion turns to rage. Edward did this. He built these cameras into the very fabric of One Folgate Street. Why? Was it some voyeuristic hobby? Or just another way of owning every moment of my life? I'm pretty sure it's not even legal. Wasn't someone sent to prison recently for something like this? But then I realize Edward wouldn't have left a detail like that to chance. I go through my old emails until I find one from Camilla with One Folgate Street's terms and conditions attached. Buried deep in the small print, I locate the clause I'm looking for. Including, but not limited to, photographic and moving images. Something else strikes me. Edward built this house, but the person who designed the technology was his partner, David Teal. And while I might have a hard time picturing Edward as a high-tech peeping Tom, Teal's another matter. I don't give my anger a chance to dissipate. I go and get my coat. Now, Jane. I don't bother with an appointment. I simply wait on the ground floor of the Hive until a group of Monkford Partnership employees, clutching lattes and wraps, gather around one of the lifts and follow them in. At the 14th floor, I follow them out again. Edward isn't here, the impeccable brunette on reception says when she gets over her surprise. It's David Teal I want to talk to. Now she looks even more surprised. I'll see if he's free. She has to look up his extension number on her iPad. I get the impression the technologist doesn't get many visitors. My rant at David Teal is long, loud, and liberally laced with swear words. I barely draw breath. But he simply waits calmly for me to finish. I'm reminded of the way Edward listened to that client the first time I came here, letting the man's anger wash over him. This is ludicrous, Teal says when I'm finally done. I think your condition must be causing you to overreact. He could hardly have said anything more calculated to set me off again. First, I'm not ill, you cretin, and second, don't you dare patronize me. I know what I saw. You've been spying on me, and you can't deny it. It's even in the bloody terms and conditions. He shakes his head. We ask you to sign a disclaimer, but that's just to cover ourselves. No one accesses those camera feeds apart from the automatic face recognition software. It's so the house can track your movements, that's all. And the shower? I demand. Going hot and cold, trying to freak me out? You're not telling me that's something to do with face recognition? He frowns. I wasn't aware of any problems with the shower. And then there's the really important thing. What were those cameras doing when Emma was killed? They must have recorded what happened. He hesitates. The FR feeds were offline that day. A technical problem. It was unfortunate timing, that's all. You really can't expect me. I begin, just as the door swings open, propelled with some force by Edward Monkford's arm as he strides into the room. What are you doing here? He demands of me. I've never seen him so angry. She wants the data from One Folgate Street relating to the Matthews woman, Teal says. Edward flushes with fury. This has gone far enough. I want you out. Do you hear? For a moment, I'm not sure if he means out of his office or One Folgate Street. But then he adds, We're invoking the penalty notice. You have 5 days to leave the house. You can't do that. You're in breach of at least a dozen restrictive covenants. I think you'll find we can. Edward, what are you so frightened of? What are you trying to hide? I'm not frightened of anything,
I'm pissed off at constantly having my wishes ignored by you. To be honest, I actually find it amusing that you accuse me of being obsessed with Emma Matthews when clearly you're the one who's fixated on her. Why couldn't you just leave it? Why do you care so much? You gave me her necklace, I say, equally angry. If you're so innocent, why did you have her necklace repaired and then give it to me? He looks at me as if I'm crazy. I gave you both similar necklaces because I happened to like the colour of those pearls. That's all. Did you kill her, Edward? I hear myself asking, because it certainly looks as if you did. Where do you get this from? He says incredulously. Who puts these crazy ideas in your head? I want an answer. I'm trying to sound calm, but my voice is shaking. Well, you're not going to get one. Now get the hell out! Teal says nothing. Edward stares furiously at my bump as I get up to leave. Now, Jane. I have nowhere to go except back to 1 Folgate Street. But I enter it with trepidation now, like a bloodied fighter stepping back into the ring for yet another round. The feeling of being watched is all-pervasive now, the feeling of being played with too. Small things around the house randomly malfunction. Electrical sockets choose not to work, lights fade up and down. When I type 1-bed flats into housekeeper's search engine, it takes me to a site about women who lie to their partners. When I turn on the sound system, it selects Chopin's Funeral March. The burglar alarm goes off, startling me. Stop being so fucking childish! I shout at the ceiling. The silence of the empty rooms is the only mocking reply. I get my phone. Simon, I say when he answers, if that offer still stands, I would like you to come around tonight, after all. Jane, what's wrong? He says, instantly concerned. You sound frightened. Not frightened, exactly, I lie. Just a little freaked out by this place. I'm sure it's nothing to worry about, but it would be good to see you anyway. Now, Jane. I came as soon as I could, Simon says, dumping a bag by the door. That's the advantage of being freelance, I guess. I can work from here just as easily as from a Starbucks. He looks at my face and stops. Jane, are you sure you're all right? You look terrible. Simon, I've got an apology to make. All this time you've been telling me that Edward killed Emma, and I've been dismissing it. But now I'm starting to think... I hesitate, unwilling even to put this into words. I'm starting to think you may be right. No need to apologize, Jane. But can you tell me what's changed your mind? I tell him about the cameras and my confrontation with Teal. And then I came straight out and accused Edward of giving me the same necklace as Emma. I add. Simon stares at me, suddenly tense. How did he take that? He said they were 2 different necklaces. Could he prove it? He didn't even try to. He just threw me out. I shrug resignedly. I have 5 days to find somewhere else. You can stay with me for a while, if you want. Thank you. But really, I've imposed on you quite enough. We will stay friends, though, Jane, won't we? Leaving here won't mean you just forget all about me. Of course not, I say, a little embarrassed by his neediness. Anyway, now I have a moral dilemma. I gesture at the table, where my necklace lies curled in its clamshell case. All this stuff about necklaces
made me look up how much it's worth. It turns out to be around £3,000.
He raises his eyebrows.
Which would be a pretty hefty deposit on a flat.
Exactly. But I think I should give it back to Edward.
Why? If he chooses to give you something valuable, that's his problem.
Yes, but I struggle to explain. I don't want him to think I only care about its financial value. The trouble is, I do need the money.
And I don't want to make him more contemptuous of me than he already is, I think, but don't say out loud.
It says so much about you that this is even a dilemma, Jane.
Most people wouldn't hesitate for a moment.
Simon smiles. The tension he displayed just now when I talked about Edward and the pearls has vanished. Why was he so tense? What did he think I was going to say? Then something occurs to me. Something tiny, but completely obvious. If Simon's right, and my necklace is the one Edward previously gave Emma, one of the strings will have one less pearl than the others. But looking at it now, it seems to me that each string is exactly the same. I run my fingers over the top string, counting quickly. 24 pearls. The second string also has 24 pearls, so does the third. Edward was telling the truth. The necklace he gave me wasn't the one he gave Emma after all. The scenario Simon described, in which Edward killed Emma, then picked up all but one of the loose pearls, never happened. Unless it was Simon. The thought floats into my brain, fully formed. What if it all happened just as Simon said? But to him, not Edward. You have no proof, I tell myself. But suddenly, I feel a whole lot less happy about having this man spend the night here. Something else occurs to me. There have been no technical malfunctions at 1 Folgate Street while Simon's here. The water flows from the taps, the stove works, even housekeeper stays unlocked. Why is that? Unless he was somehow causing it all. Teal had looked shamefaced when I confronted him, but he'd also looked puzzled, and he'd said something about a problem. Was he only embarrassed because he knew someone else had accessed 1 Folgate Street systems? Have I been getting this all wrong?
14. I try not to let people know what I'm really thinking. Agree? Or disagree.
Now, Jane.
Jane, are you all right?
Simon's watching me closely.
Yes, I shake myself and give him a little smile. It was sweet of you to come, though actually there was no need to bring a bag. My friend Mia just texted. She's going to stay the night.
Doesn't Mia have kids? And a husband?
His tone is solicitous.
Yes, but...
Well, there you go. They need her. And I'm here now. Besides, it'll be like old times.
Old times? How? I say, confused. He gestures.
You and me, here together.
That's not old times, Simon.
His smile doesn't waver.
But not far off. For me, anyway.
Simon, I don't know how to say this. I'm not Emma. I'm nothing like her.
Of course not. You're a better person than she was, for one thing.
I pick up my phone from the table.
What are you doing? He asks.
I should really put the necklace back upstairs, I lie.
I'll do it.
He holds out his hand.
You're pregnant. You should be taking it easy.
Not that pregnant.
I suddenly think of something else. Simon started making references to my pregnancy long before other people even noticed. Most people think a small amount of alcohol is okay at around 15 weeks. How does he know how many weeks I am? I start to move past him. He keeps his hand out, but I ignore him.
Careful on those stairs, he calls, watching me.
I force myself to slow down, acknowledging the warning with a wave. Apart from the hall, the only place in One Folgate Street with a door is the cleaner's cupboard. I slip inside, wedging it shut with brooms and mops. I try Mia first. Call failed.
Shit, I say aloud. Bloody shit!
Edward Monkford. Call failed. 999. Call failed. Looking at the screen, I see there's no signal. With some difficulty, I hoist myself into the roof space and hold the phone up as high as I can. No signal here either.
Jane?
It's Simon's voice calling up from downstairs.
Jane, are you all right?
I need you to go away, Simon, I shout back. I'm not feeling well.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'll call a doctor.
Please don't. I just need to rest.
I hear his voice getting louder as he comes upstairs.
Jane, where are you? Are you in the bathroom?
I don't reply.
Knock, knock.
No, not in the bathroom.
Are we playing hide and seek?
The door of the cupboard creaks as he pushes it from outside.
Found you, he says happily. Come on out now, babe.
Now, Jane.
I'm not going to come out, I say through the door.
This is stupid. I can't talk to you in there.
Simon, I want you to go, or I'll call the police.
How? I've got a gadget that blocks cell phone signals, Wi-Fi too.
I don't reply. I'm slowly realizing this is even worse than I thought. He's planned this.
All I wanted was to be with you, he adds. But you still prefer Monkford to me, don't you?
What's Monkford got to do with it?
He doesn't deserve you, just like he didn't deserve her. But nice guys don't get nice girls, do they? They lose them to pricks like him.
Simon, I have a signal. I'm calling the police.
I raise my phone and say urgently,
please, please. The address is 1 Folgate Street, Hendon. There's a man in my house who's threatening me.
Not strictly true, babe. I haven't threatened anyone.
Yes, 5 minutes is fine, but please hurry.
Very convincing. You're a good liar, Jane. Just like every other woman I've ever fucking met.
I flinch as he unleashes a sudden barrage of kicks on the door. The mops and brooms bend, but don't give way. I'm dizzy with terror.
Doesn't bother me, Jane, he says, panting. I've got all day.
I hear him go back downstairs. Long minutes pass. I catch the smell of frying bacon. Absurdly, it makes my mouth water. I look around the cupboard, wondering if there's anything here I can use. My eyes light on the cables lining the wall, the veins and arteries of 1 Folgate Street. I start pulling them out at random. It must have some effect, because soon I hear him coming back up the stairs.
Very clever, Jane, but a bit annoying too, actually. Come on out now, I've made you some food.
Go away, Simon! Don't you see? You've got to go, I mean it!
You sound just like Emma when you're angry.
There's the sound of a knife scraping across a plate. I picture him sitting cross-legged on the other side of the cupboard door, eating what he's cooked. I should have said no to her more often. I should have been more forceful. That was always my problem. Too reasonable. Too nice. I hear a cork being pulled from a bottle. I thought maybe you were nice as well, so it would be different this time. But it wasn't.
David Teal!
I shout.
Edward! Help!
I shout until my throat is sore and my voice hoarse.
They can't hear you, he says at last.
They can,
I insist.
They're watching.
Is that what you thought? Afraid not. That was me.
You remind me so much of her, you see. I've been in love with you for ages.
It isn't love, I say, horrified. Love can't be totally one-sided.
Love is always one-sided, Jane, he says sadly. I try to stay calm.
If you did love me, you'd want me to be happy, not scared and trapped in here.
I do want you to be happy, with me. But if I can't have you, I certainly won't let that prick have you instead.
I told you, I broke up with him.
That's what she said.
He sounds weary. So I gave her a test, a simple test, and she wanted him back. Not me, him.
I didn't want it to be like this, Jane. I wanted you to fall in love with me, but this is the next best thing.
I hear the sound of a zipper as he opens his bag, then a sloshing sound. A dark stain creeps under the cupboard door. It smells like lighter fluid.
Simon!
I scream. For fuck's sake!
I can't, Em.
His voice sounds snotty and thick, like he's on the verge of crying.
Can't let it go.
Please, Simon, think of the baby. Even if you hate me, think of the baby.
Oh, I do. The bastard's little bastard. His cock in your cunt. His child. No fucking way.
Another slosh.
I'm gonna burn this place. He won't like that much, will he? And I'll be forced to burn you and the baby with it if you don't come out. Don't make me do that, Jane.
All these cleaning products will be flammable. One by one, I throw them up into the roof space. Then I clamber up after them and check for a dial tone again. Still nothing.
Jane, Simon calls through the door. Last chance. Come out and be nice to me. Pretend you love me just for a little while. Just pretend. That's all I'm asking.
I inch along the crawl space, using my phone as a torch. There are wooden crossbeams and trusses everywhere. Once a fire gets hold up here, there'll be no stopping it. In any case, I seem to remember that in house fires, it's the smoke that kills you. I step on something soft. The old sleeping bag. Something else clicks in my mind. It wasn't Emma who was sleeping up here. It was Simon. He had some of Emma's stuff and her therapist's card. Maybe he even thought about getting some help. If only he had.
Jane, he calls again. Jane!
And then I see my suitcase, the one I put up here out of the way. Crouching down, I take out Isabel's memory box. With trembling hands, I touch her things. The cloth she was swaddled in, the plaster casts of her tiny hands and feet. All that's left of her.
I've let you down. Both of you.
I slump to my knees, my hands on my bump, and let the tears come.
15. Your child has gotten into difficulty in the sea. As you go to rescue her, you realize she is only one of about 10 children in the same predicament. You can either rescue your daughter immediately, or go and get help for the whole group, which may take some time. Which do you do? Save your own child? Save 10 other children?
Now, Jane. I don't know how long I cry, but when I finished, there's still no smell of fire, only the acrid reek of lighter fluid. I think of Simon somewhere below me, feeling sorry for himself too, his pathetic, needy snivelling. And I think, no. I am not Emma Matthews, disorganized and vulnerable. I am a mother who has buried one child and carries another inside me. It would be so easy to stay here in this attic, luxuriating in the sweet passivity of grief, to lie down and wait for the smoke to seep up through the joists, wrapping itself around me, pulling me down. But that is not what I do. Some primeval instinct propels me to my feet. Almost before I'm aware of it, I'm lowering myself down through the hatch again. Quietly, I take the mops and brooms away from the cupboard door. The necklace is still in my pocket. Pulling it out, I snap the strings, letting the pearls fall loose into my hand. Softly, gently, I open the door. 1 Folgate Street is unrecognizable. The walls are daubed with graffiti. Pillows and cushions have been ripped apart. Smashed crockery litters the floor. There's what looks like blood smeared across the plate glass windows. As well as lighter fluid, I catch the smell of natural gas from the stove. As if from nowhere, he appears at the foot of the stairs. Jane, I'm so glad. I can be her for you. I haven't planned this, not in any detail, but now it seems obvious to me what I have to say, and the words come out of my mouth without hesitation or tremors. Emma. Nice Emma. The one you loved. I'll be Emma for you, and then you'll let me go, yes? He stares up at me without replying. I try to imagine how Emma might have spoken, the rhythms of her voice. Wow, I say, looking around. You've really done a number on this place, haven't you, babe? You must really love me, Si, to do all this. I never realized how passionate you were. Suspicion battles in his eyes with something else. Happiness? Love? I place a hand on my belly. Simon, there's something you should know. You're going to be a dad. Isn't that great? He flinches. The bastard's little bastard. Let's go and lie down, Si, I say quickly, sensing I've taken this too far. Just for a few minutes. I'll rub your back and you can rub mine. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? A cuddle would be nice. Nice, he repeats, coming up the stairs. His voice is hoarse with longing. Yes. Will you take a shower? He nods. Then something hardens in his gaze. You too. I'll just get a robe. I walk toward the bedroom, feeling his eyes follow me. I open the stone cupboard and slip a bathrobe from its hanger. I catch the sound of water. He must have turned the shower on. But when I turn, he's back in the same spot, still watching me. I can't do it, Em, he says suddenly. For a moment, I think he means this charade. Can't do what, babe? Can't lose you. Can't let you be that person who wants them but not me. He says the words in a strange, sing-song way, like they're the lyrics of a song that's been going around and around his brain so long they've lost any meaning. But I do want you, babe.
No one else. Come on, I'll show you.
With a sudden gasping sob, he buries his head in his hands, and I seize my chance, dodging past him toward the stairs, the treacherous stairs where Emma died. I almost tumble on the top step, my heavy belly unbalancing me, but then I put a hand to the wall and manage to steady myself, my bare feet sure on the familiar slabs. With a roar of anger, he lunges after me. Somehow, he gets a hand into my hair and jerks me toward him. I fling the handful of pearls at his head. He barely flinches. But when he goes for the next step, they're under his feet, lethal as ball bearings, and his arms flail wildly as his legs skate off in different directions. Surprise and shock are written across his face, and then he's falling, falling into the void. His body hits the floor first, his head following with a sickening crack. Pearls patter down the stairs like a waterfall, tumbling over the side after him, bouncing around his twisted, spread-eagle body. There's a moment when I'm sure he's still alive, because his eyes look up at me, anguished, searching me out, reluctant to let go. And then the blood seeps from the back of his head, and his gaze goes dead. Now, Jane. I try again for a dial tone, but Simon's jammer must still be working. I'm going to have to go next door to call an ambulance. Not that there's any great rush now. His eyes are open and unmoving, and his head has a halo of dark red blood. Carefully, I pick my way down the stairs and around the living room, skirting the pearls that still dangerously litter the floor, one hand curled protectively over my belly. My path brings me close to the big glass windows. Almost unconsciously, I stop and wipe at the bloody graffiti with my sleeve. It comes off easily, revealing the reflection of my face against the darkness beyond. It will all come off, I think. All this mess, this superficial disorder. The blood in Simon's body will soon be gone. The house will be pristine again. Like a living organism expelling a tiny splinter, one Folgate Street has healed itself. I feel an overwhelming sense of serenity, of peace. I look at my reflection in the dark glass, feeling the house acknowledge me. Both of us, in our different ways, ripe with possibility.
16. A railway signalman is responsible for changing the points at a remote junction. Against regulations, he takes his son to work, but gives him strict instructions not to go near the line. Later, he sees a train approaching, but before he can change the points, he spots the boy playing on the track, too far away to hear him. Unless the points are changed, the train will almost certainly crash, causing multiple fatalities. But if he does change them, the train will almost certainly kill his son. Whichever he chooses, he will only have a few seconds to run out and try to warn the train driver and his son before the impact. Change the points. Don't change the points.
Now, Jane. I never do get to have a water birth, with diptyque candles perfuming the air and Jack Johnson playing on my iPad. Instead, I have a caesarean, following the discovery during a routine scan of a small blockage in my baby's stomach. Nothing that immediate postnatal surgery can't fix, thank heaven, but it tips the scales from a natural to a medical birth. Dr. Gifford is careful to explain the implications, and I undergo some further tests before it's all agreed. After the birth, I hold Toby for just a few bittersweet, wonderful minutes, then they whisk him away. But not before the midwife has put him to my breast
and I felt his hard gums working at my nipple, the deep pulling sensation reaching into my very core, right down to my tender uterus, followed by the tingling euphoria of letdown. Love flows from me into him, and his blue eyes crinkle, huge and happy. Such a smiley baby. The midwife says it can't be a real smile, not yet. Just some passing gas or a random quiver of his lip. But I know she's wrong. Edward comes to visit us the day after. I've seen him quite a few times during my final trimester, partly because of all the legal bureaucracy that followed Simon's death, and partly because Edward has had the grace to admit he should have realized himself how dangerous Simon was. We're in this together for the long term now, as co-parents, and if, in the fullness of time, we can be more than that, well, that's a possibility, I sometimes think, that Edward no longer quite rules out. I'm still sleepy when he arrives, so the nurse checks with me first. But of course I say to let him in. I want to show him our son. Here he is. Here's Toby. I'm unable to stop myself from smiling, but I'm apprehensive too. The habit of being judged by Edward, of seeking his approval, is too recent to have altogether faded. He lifts Toby high in his arms and examines his round, cheerful face. "When did you know?" he says quietly. "That he has Down syndrome. After they found the blockage, nearly a third of babies with duodenal atresia have it. The DNA test, so much more than 99% accurate, hadn't been infallible after all. But after the shock and grief of the initial confirmation, there's a part of me that's almost glad the test was wrong. If I'd known, I would certainly have had an abortion, and looking at Toby now, at the almond-shaped eyes, the snub nose, and the gorgeous bow-shaped mouth, how could I possibly wish this life unlived? Of course, there are worries. But every child with Down syndrome is different, and it looks as if we've been lucky. He's barely floppier than any other baby. His oral coordination, when he mouths at my nipple, seems good. He has no problem swallowing, no heart defects or kidney problems, and his nose, though stubby, is still recognizably Edward's. His eyes, though almond-shaped, not so dissimilar to my own. He's beautiful. "Jane," Edward says urgently, "this may not be the easiest time or place to hear this, but you have to give him up. There are people who adopt such babies, people who choose that to be their life, not people like you." "I couldn't," I say. "Edward, I just couldn't." Just for a moment, I see, deep in his eyes, a flash of anger. And something else too, perhaps. The tiniest glimmer of fear. "We could try again," he continues, as if I haven't spoken. "You and me, a clean slate. We could make it work this time. I know we could." "If you'd been more honest with me about Emma," I say, "we might have made it work before." He looks at me sharply. I can see him wondering if this is what motherhood has done to me, if it has already somehow changed me, made me more assertive. "How could I talk to you about it when I didn't even understand it myself?" he says at last. "I'm an obsessive person, and she loved to provoke me. She found it exciting when she managed to make me lose control, even though I hated myself for it. In the end, I did break off with her, but it was hard, very hard." He hesitates. "She gave me a letter once. She said she wanted to explain herself. Later, she asked me not to read it. But by then, I already had." "Did you keep it?"
Yes. Do you want to see it?
No, I decide. I look down at Toby's sleeping face. It's the future we need to think about now. He seizes on that.
So you will consider it. You'll think about giving this one up.
I think I could be a father again, Jane. I think I'm ready for that. But let's have the child we want to have. A child that's been planned. And that, finally, is when I tell Edward the truth.
Then, Emma. I knew even before I met you, when the agents started talking about your rules. Some women, perhaps most women, want to be cherished and respected. They want a man who's sweet and kind, who whispers words of gentleness and love. I've tried to be that woman, and to love that man. But I can't. As soon as I spilled the coffee on your plans, I was sure. Something I couldn't even put into words had happened. You were stern and powerful, but you forgave me. Simon could do the forgiveness, but it was out of weakness, not strength. In that moment, I became yours. I don't want to be cherished. I want to be commanded. I want a monstrous man, a man other men hate and envy and who doesn't give a shit. A man made of stone. Once or twice, I thought I'd found that man. And then I could never be the one to tear myself away. When those men used me and threw me aside, I accepted it as nothing more than the proof they really were who they claimed to be. One of those men was Saul. I found him disgusting at first, an arrogant, loathsome creep. I thought because he was married to Amanda, his flirting didn't mean anything. So I let myself flirt back, and that was my mistake. He got me drunk. I knew what he was doing, but I thought there was a point where he'd stop. He didn't. And I suppose I didn't either. It felt like it was all happening to someone else. I know this will sound strange, but it felt like I was Audrey Hepburn dancing with Fred Astaire, not a drunk PA giving a senior manager a seedy blowjob at a corporate training day. And by the time I realized I didn't like what he was doing or the way he was doing it, it was too late. The more I tried to stop him, the rougher he got. I hated myself after that. I thought it was my fault for letting him get me into that situation. And I hated Simon for always seeing the best in me when actually, I'm not the person he thinks I am. It was just so much easier to lie to everyone than to tell the truth. So you see, in you, I thought I'd finally found someone who was kind as well as strong. Simon as well as Saul. And when I realized you had secrets too, I was glad. I thought we could be honest with each other. That we could finally rid ourselves of all the clutter from our past. Not our possessions, but the stuff we carry around inside our heads. Because that's what I've realized, living in One Folgate Street. You can make your surroundings as polished and empty as you like, but it doesn't really matter if you're still messed up inside. And that's all anyone's looking for, really, isn't it? Someone to take care of the mess inside our heads.
17. It is better to tell a lie and remain in control of a situation than to tell the truth with unpredictable results. Agree or disagree?
Now, Jane. He was planned, I say. Edward frowns.
Is that a joke?
Perhaps 10% of a joke. He starts to relax. But then I add, that's to say he was planned by me, just not by you. I tuck Toby tighter into the crook of my arm. I knew the very first time I met you, actually, that time at your office, I knew you could be the father of my child. Good-looking, intelligent, creative, driven. You were certainly the best I was likely to find.
You lied to me,
he says incredulously.
Not really. There were a few things I didn't explain, that's all.
Not least when I answered the very first question on the application, the one demanding a list of everything essential to my life. When you've lost the center of your universe, there's only one thing that can possibly make you whole again. I could never have done it anywhere but One Folgate Street. Second thoughts, self-doubts, moral qualms, in the ordinary world, they would have paralyzed me. But in those stark, uncompromising spaces, my resolve only grew and grew. One Folgate Street colluded in my plans, and all my decisions had the clean simplicity of loss.
I knew something was going on.
Edward has gone very pale.
Housekeeper, there were some anomalies, data that didn't make sense. I put it down to your obsession with Emma's death, this ridiculous quest you were trying to keep secret.
I didn't care about Emma. Not personally. But I had to know if you could be a danger to our child. Ironically, it was Simon's death that finally allowed me to resolve that question. In his blue folder, I found the name of John Watts, the site foreman at 1 Folgate Street. Emma had been given it by Edward's former business partner, Tom Ellis, but in her usual chaotic way had never followed it up. The foreman confirmed what I was already almost certain of, that the deaths of Edward's wife and child were just a tragic accident. I don't feel sorry for you, Edward, I add. You got exactly what you wanted. A brief, intense, perfect affair. Any man who sleeps with a woman under those conditions should know there may be consequences. I feel no guilt about Simon, either. I knew when I closed the lid on Isabel's memory box that I'd kill him if I could. But by the time the police arrived, I'd picked up all the loose pearls, and there was nothing to suggest I'd played any part in his sad, unfortunate death. Was what I did acceptable, or at the very least, understandable? Can any woman say that in my shoes she wouldn't have done the same?
Oh, Jane.
Edward shakes his head.
Jane, how? Magnificent. All the time I thought I was controlling you, you were actually controlling me. I should have known you had your own agenda.
Can you forgive me?
Who knows better than me what it's like to lose a child? He says quietly. How you'll do anything, however destructive or wrong, that seems to numb the pain. Perhaps we're more alike than either of us realized.
For a long moment, he's silent, lost in his own thoughts. After Max and Elizabeth died, I became quite deranged for a while, mad with guilt and grief and self-hatred, he says at last. I went to Japan to try to get away from myself, but nothing helped. And then when I came back, I discovered Tom Ellis was planning to finish 1 Folgate Street and put his own name to it. I couldn't bear to see the house Elizabeth and I had planned together, our family home, come into existence like that. So I tore up the plans and started again. I didn't really care what kind of place I built instead, to be honest. I built something as sterile and empty as a mausoleum, because that was how I felt at the time. But then I realized that in my madness, I'd inadvertently created something extraordinary. A house that would demand a sacrifice from anyone who lived there, but repay that sacrifice 1,000-fold in return. There are some, like Emma, it destroys, of course. But others, like you, it makes stronger. He stares at me intently,
Don't you see, Jane? You've shown you're worthy of it, that you're disciplined and ruthless enough to be one Folgate Street's mistress. So I'm making you an offer. His gaze never leaves mine. If you'll give this baby up for adoption, I'll give you the house. Your house, now, to do with as you choose. But the longer you leave it, the harder this decision will become. What do you really want? A chance of perfection? Or a lifetime of trying to cope with... He gestures wordlessly at Toby. The future you were always meant to have, Jane. Or that.
18. Give up the baby. Don't give up the baby.
Now, Jane. And if I say yes, we'll have another child. You have my word on it. He seizes on my hesitation. It wouldn't just be the right thing for us, Jane. It would be right for Toby. Better for a child like him to be adopted now than to grow up without a father. He has a father. You know what I mean. He needs parents who can accept him for what he is, not who grieve for the child who might have been every time they look at him. You're right, I say quietly. He does need that. I think of One Folgate Street, the sense of belonging and calm I feel there. And I look at Toby and think of what's to come. A single mother, alone with her disabled child, battling the system to get the therapies he needs. A life of turmoil and muddle and compromise. Or a chance to try again for something better and more beautiful. There's a posset of regurgitated milk on Toby's shoulder. Carefully, I wipe it away. There. All gone. I make my decision. I will take what I can from Edward, and then I will let them fade into history. All the characters in this drama, Emma Matthews and the men who loved her, who became obsessed with her. They're not important to us now. But one day, when Toby is old enough, I will take down a shoebox from the shelf where it is kept, and I will tell him again the story of his sister, Isabel Margaret Cavendish, the girl who came before.
Now, Estrel. It's extraordinary, I say, looking in disbelief at the pale stone walls, the space, the light. I've never seen such an amazing house, not even in Denmark. It is rather special, Camilla agrees. The architect's actually rather famous. Do you remember the fuss last year about that eco-town in Cornwall? It was something about the residents refusing to accept the terms of their leases, wasn't it? Didn't he get them all thrown out? The lease here is quite complicated too, Camilla says. If you want to take this any further, I should probably talk you through it. I look around me, at the soaring walls, the floating staircase, the incredible serenity and calm. In such a place, I think, I could be whole again. Put all the bitterness and rage of the divorce behind me. I'm definitely interested, I hear myself say. Good. Oh, and by the way, Camilla's looking up at the roof void now, as if reluctant to meet my eye. I'm sure you'll Google the address anyway, so there's no point in not telling you. The house does have a bit of history. A young couple who lived here. First she fell down the stairs and died, and then 3 years later he died in exactly the same spot. They think he must have thrown himself down deliberately to be with her.
Well, it's certainly tragic, I say. But as tragedies go, quite romantic. If you're asking whether that would put me off, it wouldn't. Anything else I should know? Just that the owner can be a bit of a tyrant. I must have shown dozens of prospective tenants around in the last few weeks, and none of them have been accepted. Believe me, I know how to deal with tyrants. I lived with one for 6 years. And so, that evening, I find myself leafing through the endless pages of the application form. So many rules to read, and so many questions to answer. It's tempting to get myself a drink to help me through it. But I haven't had one for almost 3 weeks now, and I'm trying to keep it that way. Please make a list of every possession you consider essential to your life. I take a deep breath and pick up my pen.
This is Amelia Fox. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Girl Before by J.P. Delaney. This program was directed by Ali Mjodin, executive producer Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2017 by J.P. Delaney. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.